Brad was from a small town in southern Minnesota. His real name was Jerome Jervy, and he was in Vietnam. And he told me his story. I've got it. I'll give it to you. But to the best of my knowledge, I'm not sure. I can't remember the details. Whether he was the one who told me about shooting kids when they went across the bridge or not. I know, I think he was on a hill when so many people got killed and he killed so many people. And he was psycho to some extent. And he wore, I think he wore a swallowtail coat, I'm not sure, and white socks, and had a long beard, and he was psycho. I've seen him since up here, you know that, and he's still affected, but he's okay. He told me that the thing I remember the most about it was that he was on an LSD trip one time, and he said that he was in this room. And he was really freaking out, and he went under the table. He hid under the table. And he said he was barking like a dog or something. It was really something. And that one of his friends said, "Come on out, old Fred." And he said he came out, but that he cried for everything. He said he just wept for what he had done, all the people that he had killed. And he said that it was, he didn't use the word epiphany, but it was. He said that he determined he would never hurt another person as long as he lived. And he said that he had been tested. This is what I remember the most about him. And he said that once he was hitchhiking, well, he's never really become a part of the system. I don't know what kind of a living he makes today, but he was not fit to go back and just get a job and settle down and live a normal kind of a life. Now, I think he's been married now. Maybe still has a child, and he's doing pretty good, but he's not the person he would have been otherwise. But he said that he was hitchhiking. He was picked up by some drunk Indians, and he said that they said they were going to beat him up. And he said, "Well, why are you going to beat me up?" And they said, "Because, you know," gave him whatever reasons. He was white and they didn't like him. So he said, "Why don't you just let me out? I'm not hurting you." And they said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to run like hell if you let me out." And he said they let him out, and he ran. And he said he doesn't fight. He said he won't fight anybody for any reason whatsoever. So he was, some of them, there was another man, what was his name, Jerry somebody, who was picked up by the police or somebody, because he'd refused to go to the military, but he did go then. He just did go. So
talk about and use your own judgment as far as what you want to talk about. But in the broad, we're getting into the area of Marshall, of the 60s, of the Vietnam War, Connie Shop, Barbara Melinda, and so forth, but maybe you could confine it to start with just with any other related experience with the Vietnam and Marshall, and
well,
anything you care to share. That's
okay, I'll try to think about. I had a call from somebody that had been at the fair or something, and said that she wanted to meet me, and that was Judy Plank. And Judy Plank is a Quaker, and her husband was Paul Plank, who was a teacher. So Judy Plank and Margaret Tesdale, who was married to Lauren Tesdale, and they're Quakers. The three of us decided we would form what was called a committee of concern. So we wrote letters. We'd write letters to the editor, and we'd write letters and that sort of thing. Then about the war, and then Then we had another, a bigger committee of Marshall people who weren't concerned about the war. And especially one Christmas. And then there were people from the college who were concerned. And there was a Christmas bombing. I think it was the bombing of Cambodia. And it occurred Christmas. And we were all beside ourselves. And so we decided that we should go to the churches. And one of the men, I've forgotten his name, Smith was his name, little man, you know, little. And we went and we did. We had signs and we went to that Lutheran church that was there kind of behind us, which is a, you know, pretty conservative Lutheran church with signs about no killing and so forth. And those people came out of the church, they were so mad at us, and one of them started to fight this Smith, this, I forgot his name, was gonna fight him. And it was a father with a little kid on his shoulders, I'll never forget that. But those church people were as mad at us as anybody could be over disturbing their Christmas. It was Christmas Eve and we were disturbing their Christmas. The people at Marshall were really mad at me, and they stayed mad at me as long as I was there, because I didn't never shut up. I never shut up. And see, what else did we do? We did everything we could do.
I remember in particular the Silent March.
I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. We marched down the highway silently, and people Marshall got in their cars and trucks and lined them up along the route to watch us and kind of
cheer,
poke fun at us or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, I think I've told you, when I go back, I'm treated like the queen. I told you that, didn't I?
No.
No, it is something peculiar. But you would think that I was, that everybody loved me when I go back there. When I say everybody, you know, I think the newspaper and I'm just treated just royally. If people stop me on the streets, it's like I'm the queen, which is kind of peculiar. Let's see what else I can tell you about Marshall.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, but...
Oh, everything.
Yeah.
Connie Shop. Well, we should have known about that. I mean, I think we should have known that would...
It wasn't gonna work out.
Yeah, and Peter, you know, Peter was there, you remember. Mm-hmm. He was part of that. And it was really because Connie was so bored with school. Mm-hmm. She was just so unhappy with school.
Right.
And it was funny, who was I talking to not so long ago that was telling me about their kids and how bored they were with school?
Okay.
And so it's not unusual, it's pretty common, I think, if the kids are, you know, I don't even want to use the word intelligence, because I think more and more that we're all equally intelligent. I think we've discussed this. I don't even know that there is a difference in our intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think that what happens to us makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're born on the economic ladder, whether there's reading in our house,
mm-hmm.
whether we're stimulated, whether we get good food.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so, you know, Vargas is the one who first told me this, because he believes this, that we're all, unless we're physically impaired, of course.
Right.
But that we are all, so once I believe that, then I look at a man who drives a garbage truck, who no doubt could have been a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know where I got off on this, but...
Connie Shop,
okay.
And my recollection is that, I can't remember his name, but he Melinda had worked at a store.
Marcotte?
And was that it?
The jeweler?
No.
Not the
shoe store. It was a shoe store.
Okay.
It's the back of the shoe store. And Melinda had worked there for a while, but at any rate, that's what I recall. And the other businessman in the town closed it down because they put pressure on him that there was drugs back there. And
I think it was the jeweler, Marcotte.
Really?
And he knew your dad.
Okay.
And he was a friend of your father's.
Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe you're right.
Yeah, there were letters to the editor. I may have them someplace.
Sure.
And some woman wrote letters about the den of iniquity in Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was kind of like with your paper. Your dad said, you know, it's going to cost me my job if it stays open any longer. And he was right, it would have. And so it had to be closed up. But I think Connie was, then she left and went to Philadelphia, if you remember.
Okay.
And I think being there, she didn't, you know, I thought she was going to school there.
Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Okay.
With Barbara and Peter.
Uh-huh.
But she couldn't. And I think she just kind of sat in a corner, and I think she avoided a mental breakdown by being there.
Mm.
Because I think she was very near to a mental breakdown when that happened. And and I remember, because I just mentioned it to somebody the other day, one of your teachers talking to me. And part of it is true,
mm-hmm.
what he said to me. Because the way we raise our children, you know, we raise our children, and we're not our parents. I never, when I raised, especially our daughters,
mm-hmm.
I looked back on how I was with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that, of course, daughters want to get away from their mothers.
Oh, right. Thank you.
Yeah,
yeah. This to me many years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so I encouraged them to leave.
Right.
And I shouldn't have done that.
Right.
I just shouldn't have done that, but I didn't know.
Yeah, you didn't know.
I didn't know. And then I was going to tell you something else about that, because it had to do with you. But anyhow, that was, it'll come to me, I think, in a minute.
And Connie moved out to Philadelphia and just vegged out for a while.
Right. And then she came back and worked in the bookstore, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She came back and I gave her a job in the bookstore.
Okay.
And then your dad told me, he said, then she met David Fromm.
Right.
And your father said she's going to leave with him. He always knew what was going on more than I did. He was much more the detective. He told me when she was smoking.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Connie's smoking. And I said, no. Yes, she is. She's smoking. And she was.
Yeah.
And then he said she's gonna leave with David Fromm and go to Philadelphia. I'm not Philadelphia, but going to go with him. Well, she did. And I was unprepared for this because it was just not part of my makeup to think that she would have done this. I mean, because people did things. I'm trying to think of what it is, Mike, that I remembered about that with you.
Or you were.
I know, but I want to think about it,
right,
because it was something.
Something
you
about how you raise kids in conventional or non-conventional or.
Oh, I know what it was. I was going to tell you about the teacher. I'm sure you remember it, because one of your teachers came up to me. I'll never forget this. And now, don't let me forget how it happened. When I grew up, I'm sure I've told you this, I had years all through high school. Everything was okay. We were poor. I mean, we weren't poor in the conventional sense. We had no money. But we were still middle class, upper middle class in a way. I mean, in our heads, maybe not upper, But we were in the right part of town.
Right.
We knew the right people. Now, don't let me forget where I'm going to go with this, because I've forgotten where I was going with this.
It's the teacher who came
up. Oh, yeah, the teacher, yeah. So, I thought the world was great. I thought the world was fine. And the real knowledge of the cruelty of the world and the bad things that go on, you know, people starved in Arkansas during those years. I never knew it. I never identified with the black people. They were, but you know, I wasn't permitted to play with people that were poor. I brought home one day a girl who was really poor, and my mother said, "Where did you find her?" I mean, it was that I shouldn't do this at all. But when I realized the truth, when I realized for me what my truth was, I felt that you all, I couldn't keep you from it. You knew it from the time because you were exposed to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we've had conversations along this line before, but anyway, go ahead.
Yes, right. And I think it does have some deleterious, I think that's the way you express it, I think that's the word, effect. I think it's like exposing a plant to the elements too soon, you know? Because before they're really hardy, then they get jarred. Well, this teacher came up to me, and he said, you know, I think you were about 14, and he said, you know, there's such a thing as being giving children too much information too early, and it's not good. It was a male teacher, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. And I said to him, I can still remember, I said, you know, my children have me as a mother, and there are some bad things about that. There's some good things about that, too. But one of the bad things is that when they grow up in a country where children their age are getting killed by the military, by a military policy of this country, they're going to know it. So they just have to take that. And then I turned and walked off. But he was telling me, I shouldn't have done it, that I shouldn't, because the school lies, the material. When I was at the social studies conference, I looked at the textbooks, and they're teaching economics in high school now. I didn't have time to look at the books, but I knew that they whitewash everything. They whitewash it. They don't give the truth. When I was in West Virginia, I lived in West Virginia during my sophomore year in high school. That was in coal country. And my Aunt Faye taught school there. She taught Latin. And the coal miners had a hard, hard life. And there were, before, probably in the 1920s, the coal miners went on strike. And the owners of the coal mines had Pinkerton guards at
the shop.
So anyhow, so where was I going with that? That whole business of that kind of information.
Well, the teacher. Let's see. You turned away from the teacher and.
Yeah, but but I was telling you about being there. Oh, I know what we were talking about. The educational material.
Right.
Okay. You know, there's not a word about those. At that time, I don't know if there is today, there was nothing in the social study books in West Virginia, nothing that told about those terrible times in which the coal miners, and they could have made it gentle, but they didn't. When you were, well, I don't know how old you were, but we were living, I think, then in Wyndham, and you had my weekly reader. You got my weekly reader.
That was Marshall.
Yeah, that's right. And you came home with my, you or one of you, came home with my weekly reader. Well, there was a picture in my weekly reader of the Iranian Shah.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember the story?
I think so. I remember that picture.
Yeah. And she's in a little white satin dress with these little white satin pumps, and it's like a fairy tale king and queen. And that's the way my weekly reader presented them. Well, the Shah of Iran was a murdering tyrant. And I was indignant, so I wrote, I wish I had a copy of that letter, but I don't. So I wrote my weekly reader, and I said, you know, you don't have to give children the full truth about it, but this is absolutely wrong that you do not give a true picture of this man and what's going on in Iran. And I don't think I had an answer to that. I also wrote a cereal company that had cereal boxes about the same time, with on the cereal boxes for kids pictures of arms, weapons. So I wrote them and the cereal company, and I said, why do you do that? Why don't you have some heroes on there, historical figures that have done good things? And they wrote back and said I was the first person that had ever mentioned this to them. In a couple of years, they didn't put the arms on them anymore. But I don't know that I had a thing to do with it, of course. Yeah. So it's just like, it's kind of like tilting at windmills, you know. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Don Quixote.
Yeah.
That's what my life has been a lot, just tilting at windmills. And what it has done, it's provided me with satisfaction. What good it's done? Probably very little. So, you know, and that's okay. That's okay. At least I'm happy what I'm doing. So, is that all I know can tell you about Marshall? There's so much, you know.
Yeah, you were there from 1960, roughly, to
See,
I graduated in 74.
I was in 68.
You were there till at least about 1980?
Yeah. Yes. That's when I came up here, 80.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You were there for...
almost 20 years.
20 years. And a lot happened during those 20 years.
Yeah.
Let's see. You went with Walter to the golf club a few times.
Yeah.
And you didn't like it.
No. You know, I tried to play golf once. You knew that.
I think I may have.
No. Yeah, well, I bought golf shoes and everything. And I thought I'd learn to play golf. And I went out there. And I felt like I was being cute. I just felt like I was just being so, I could not stand the way it made me feel. And people would say something to me, and I never could do it. I could not do it. It was just...
I think I do remember that.
It was just out. And I'm trying to remember, was it Marshall? Yeah. We belonged to the dancing club, you know. That we,
I guess I forgot or didn't know that.
Well, this was a group of people, the doctors and the lawyers and... at the end group, and we'd go dancing once a month. And I had one conversation that ended that. And that was, I'm crazy sometimes, I think. But anyhow, your daddy come home, and your father was, I hear people talk about how judges kind of agonize over their work. He never did that. Your dad never agonized over anything. But he did come home once in a while with something that did kind of bother him. And he came home and he said, you know, I sent a man to jail today, and it was really not right. I've told you this story. The man who stole the tires.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I mentioned it at the country club. And we got into this conversation. And Hedenstrom was his name. I ran into his daughter not so long ago. She's okay, but anyhow. And so, you know, the thing that your dad and I ended up with in the conversation was, who is to say that you're not smart enough to have kids? who is to say to deny
right.
you a family?
Right.
Because you're not capable of making
right.
a living.
Yeah.
And so I repeated this, and this doctor said, that's easy, I could do it in a flash. And that was kind of the consensus, and I thought, I don't want to be with these people. I just don't want to have anything to do with them. And so we quit. In Wyndham, I quit the same kind of stuff because I got baited with being a Democrat, a liberal. And it would be like people would be kind of, and maybe I was paranoid, I don't know. But it would be that they would say things to me, and I'm not centered enough to ignore it or to have the light comment, I bit it, just like a fish taking the bait. And it would upset me. And I generally don't do that. Generally, I don't bait people. I generally don't know what your position
right.
is, and then I kind of
right.
get at you. And I just thought it was so...
It's pretty mean.
Mean,
yeah.
yeah that I got, we got out of that group, too.
Mm.
So I was always going against the grain. And that's why when I sat in St. Jones, to sit there with a church full of people who, by and large, think like I do, what could be more wonderful? I mean, they don't, probably don't, oh, I don't know why I cry so much. I don't
it's
cry
okay.
ever.
Well, you're
starting. You're making me cry. But anyhow, I sit there and I look at those people, and there's a whole church full of people. And when the priest says something, the message is to love people, it's to forgive people, and everybody there claps. I think how wonderful it is that I've lived to be able to be with people who feel like this, and not be alone, and not be the person who just got this little select, a handful of people that think the way I think. It's just so rewarding. And that's why I think I'm really interested in this Every Church a Peace Church, because it's the same thing, but these are people that are actively engaged in trying to push forward that ultimate message, which is we do kill each other with our tongues, we kill each other in lots of ways, but when you put forth the effort not to, that's what's important. I'm so lucky. And I've got you here. Really, this is so nice.
When I left my church on Sunday, he said, and now this is a new pastor,
mm-hmm.
he said, now when you leave today, instead of Father, go in peace, serve the
Lord. Yes, right.
He said, now when you leave today, you have been loved, and you go out today and this week, and you find someone to love and to help, and
right.
that's your assignment.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I've never heard a pastor talk so plainly.
Isn't that wonderful?
At the end of a service to just kind of say, now here's what
right.
we're about.
And that's what, and the more people you know that believe that, the more it affects you.
Yes.
And helps you to do what you should do.
Right.
So, you know, as I told you, if your father hadn't gotten involved the way he did, I would have stayed in Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
I just never would have come here. So again, that message in the Bible, you meant it for evil, I meant it for good.
Right.
So good came out of it. I came up here.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes.
I would not have done it, Mike. I would have.
They would have been miserable for...
Well, I really wasn't miserable,
no,
but it was just not, it was just not fulfilling, you know?
Yeah.
Because I did find people, but it wasn't the same.
Yeah.
And it does, and you don't see ways to further your own mission, whatever that may be, when you're not kind of fed.
Right. Right.
So.
Right. Yeah.
So that's it.
Well, why don't we stop
there? I think we've had enough. I've got.
All right.
Walter and I really didn't plan to live in a small town. That was not one of the,
saying that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One of the things that was on our agenda. And when we came back from the war, there was absolutely nothing available in the field of law in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
He reminded me more than once that when he was a golf pro at Pine Beach, he made a lot of contacts with people that said, they call me when you get out of law school and let me help you. And he never realized how important that was.
Yeah.
But he also came from a family, his father, as a dispatcher for the Sioux Line, that's a kind of an occupation that's off to the side that isn't connected with the mainstream business. You know, if he'd come from a business family, I think that would have been more impressed upon him. So anyhow, he had never thought about that. So he looked and looked, and then he came home and said that there was this place down south. And I said, oh, down south, thinking southern United States, South Minnesota, he said. So I grew up in a comparatively small town, 30,000 people, but it was... I never felt restricted there, but I grew up in a home in which nobody challenged anything. In my family, there was no challenge made of society. We accepted, we were classist, we were racist, we were elitist, and that fit in with the community. So there was no way that we rubbed against the community, because I'm not even sure that in a town of 30,000, if you don't accept the mores of the small town, you're out. So I really, at that time, I was absolutely unaware of so much. So we went to Wyndham. And I think if I had it to do over again, I would have said, no, we won't go to a small town. We'll just be poor up here. We'll find some way to manage and stay in the city, because I am so much more in tune with the life of this city. I feel more at home here than I ever did in Wyndham or Marshall. I feel like I belong here. I have a life here. And in Wyndham, it was okay, because I hadn't then decided just how necessary I felt it was to speak out against the injustice that I see all around me. So that grew on me. And so I found life there easier. And Wyndham is a smaller town. And I think in a town that size, the people who are the power brokers, that's funny for that little bitty town, but anyhow, the people, the lawyers, the doctors, the businessmen. It's so small that they all get along together. I was never aware of any great competition or among the people that we were with. I just wasn't. So in that sense, it was easier than living in Marshall. Even before we went to Marshall, I had heard that it was a very cruel and mean town. Isn't that funny? It has a reputation for being that. It was in Wyndham. You know, we built that house. We built this house in Wyndham. And had I to do it over again, I never would have built that house. It was necessary. I felt it was necessary then. And your father never refused me anything, you know. He just didn't. If I wanted it, and it was at all possible, I got it. And so that was my idea, that we had to have a, a modern house, and I had seen work that this architect had done, and I thought we could have this house for a lot less than it actually cost us. And I couldn't, I was frustrated with children, and I had more children than I wanted too quick. And I thought, where is this going to end? Am I going to have 8 kids? And Walter's going to be out playing golf on Saturday afternoons. I think I told you that.
Yeah.
And but I love them all. And but I was frustrated. And I just thought if I could just get away, have a day or two, a week away, and do something that I felt was worthwhile. And I'm not even sure I thought that, just to do something. But it wasn't possible. And then I did play bridge, and that was the social. I don't know how much of this that you want to, but I'll talk on.
Well, let me before you go too much longer. I mean, you've covered everything we've already covered.
Okay, then let's forget it.
But let's start. Go back with what you started with, which I think was good. You came up here, and something about small town life. Can you any further define what it is about small town life? It's everybody knowing everybody's business, or what?
Absolutely. It's everybody and everybody thinking they knew who you were and putting you in a peg. And I remember reading Sinclair Lewis's Main Street, and I thought, my God, I've ended up on Main Street, and I identified immediately with a heroine of Main Street. And in which the heroine was, in this book, was amazed to find people discussed her underwear hanging on the clothesline in the back. And I remember finally being in, and I did analyze what's the problem. The problem is that people think they have a right to know everything you think. And they have, that you are obligated to tell them who you are and to constantly be in that position of this is who I am and this is what I believe. And the other part of it is that you are not supposed to, you're not entitled to believe differently from what the town itself believes. If you are, keep it to yourself. You are supposed to fit their model of who you are. Now, if you were a waitress, I'm sure this would be of no importance. They don't care what the waitress does. It's a matter of class. If you're in a certain class, then you are supposed to follow the norm. And I don't know whether I told you, but when Connie was off on something, she left school, or it was in sometime, I was in the drugstore, and the clerk in the drugstore asked me about Connie. Did I tell you about this?
Maybe.
She said, how's Connie? And I said, she's fine. Well, where is Connie? And I never answered her. And she said, well, what's she doing? And I never answered her. And I just looked at the stuff, and then I talked about it. I said, I like this, and those are nice. And then I walked away. That was the only way I could deal with it, was just simply to ignore the questions. And it's interesting, this is all ego mic for me to go on and on like this, but I will.
Well, I'm trying to keep us focused, so.
Okay. Up here, I use it. That became a tactic that I used. And up here, I used it again. I was in a workshop one day. It was, what was it called? It was on racism. And there was a black man there. And the topic was, what does it mean to be white or something. And so he was going around the room, and I didn't like his attitude. I felt it was very confrontive. So the question he was asking, and I wasn't responding to anything. I just sat there. So he said to me, well, what does it mean to you to be white? And I said, you know, I never think about being white until I'm in the presence of somebody who is white, who is not white, and then I do think about it. And then he said, well, that's kind of interesting. He said, you have that privilege, don't you? And I said, yes, I guess I do. And then he went on in a very attack mode. And then I looked at him and I said, you know, what you are doing to me, what my children call picking on me. You're picking on me, and I'm not going to answer you anymore. And so he, and then he said to a black woman who was sitting there, pretty nice, isn't it? She doesn't have to answer my question. And the black woman said, that is really funny. And they both laughed. So I sat there, and I didn't say another word. So he finally, I did say to him, because I remember this, I said, I like your shoes. Now, those are really good-looking shoes that you have on. And just anything. So then we had coffee time. I put my coat and hat on, and I left. That cost me two friends. Mm. One was a woman named, what was her name? Danielle. I'd been friends with her for years.
Her name sounds familiar.
Yeah, she worked at Wham. And she wrote me a letter and said that that she thought my behavior was impossible. And I didn't even answer it. And then she told this Indian woman that I had befriended, Sherry Wilson. I'd lent her, I think I sold her my car for $500, which was a bargain. And I had been, she was on that trip, on that boat trip, that little boat expedition when your father and I had a party. And she hadn't even been there. But they both said that I was wrong. And I didn't care. I didn't care.
Was this class taught by a white person or a black person?
Black person.
Okay.
It was a black person who taught it. So then when I recounted this to Mary Shepherd, who's my friend, and she laughed and she said, the same thing happened to me. They picked you out because they felt that you really represented
a racist person.
A class because of your age and the way you looked and the way you dressed and so forth. And but what finally happened to that man, the organization that had hired him went down the tube because they did nothing but address the issue of racism. And I don't think you can come at that straight on. Yeah. You have to deal with it in relationship to other things. So that's that. That's all.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's talk a little bit. I'm going to bring up some things from the time of Marshall, and maybe you can make a comment or two.
Okay.
The first thing that I remember is, recall the episode where Connie tried to be a waitress.
Oh, I couldn't forget it.
Talk about that a little bit.
I couldn't forget it. Well, she couldn't. I'm trying to remember if she'd held down a job in the bookstore at that time. I don't think she had, because she didn't have a job, but she was 16 or 17 years old, I think, maybe older. And she wanted a job, she wanted to get some money, so she applied for this job as this little waitress in this, I don't know where it was.
It was near Tracy's.
Near Tracy, just a little greasy spoon. And I think she worked 2 days, and she came home and they fired her. And I thought, I was really upset. I thought, here, we've raised a daughter, and she can't even be a waitress. And well, what she had happened, well, do you know what happened?
I guess not.
Well, a man had come in and he'd asked about something and ordered something, and she said, you don't want that, that's not good for you. You better have something else. And she said they served terrible food, and so she shouldn't have been there, of course, to begin with. But I thought, Connie, I had pretty much decided that she would never fit into the society, that she would be 70 years old, she would still be a hippie and not have any money and not have a job, and that I simply should accept it and go on with my life. And I did. So I'd accepted that.
I believe, I think I have the story right, when I built that go-kart,
yeah.
I think you and I went up to Minneapolis to buy the parts for it, did we not?
I don't think so. I think you went with your dad.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Maybe I went with I thought you and I went.
I don't think we did.
Let's see. I remember going up to the state fair one year when I was very little,
Yeah.
Did you make some trips to the state fair?
I think once.
From Wyndham or Marshall?
Uh-huh. Once, maybe once or twice.
Just to go, just for enjoyment, in other words.
Right, right, right. Okay. And I got so tired and I decided I never wanted to go to the state fair again.
Oh, just walking around.
Yeah, I just didn't.
Not your cup of tea.
No.
I'm trying to think of, I'm just asking you, humorous events from years in Marshall. Remember some other humorous events?
No. I can't remember much that was funny there, to tell you the truth.
I remember, this is very small, but one year for was it April Fool's Day, or I think it was April Fool's Day. The day you're supposed to play jokes on people, I put salt in the sugar bowl.
Oh, I think I remember that.
Put salt on her cereal.
Yeah, right.
Got rather upset with me.
I remember that one of my friends, and I think it was somebody that was not young, on one Halloween came around in a horrible costume, and I think you, it must have been you because you were the youngest, went to the door, and you screamed and hollered and was, do you remember that?
No.
Just scared to death of this person who'd come to the door. What else funny ever happened? Oh, your father and I started, and with this dancing club we began to, we got that music and did that, our little routine to Anything You Can Do.
Yeah.
And I saw that on the TV the other night.
Did you?
A couple doing it again. And
let's go a different route.
Okay.
Totally different route. Now we've already talked about the Quaker Tract.
Yeah, well.
That was one.
Yeah, and that kind of set me when I started reading that as far as religious material was concerned, and I read Kierkegaard, I read Kierkegaard, Purity of Heart is to Will, one thing, and I read Thomas Merton that I liked very much.
I guess rather than ask, I need to know not only what books, but why or how they impacted you. And you can say recent books too if you want, I don't care.
That's a hard question because I read. I liked Thomas Merton. What was it that he wrote? Jeez, I forgot the name of the book. Seeds of Contemplation. And I liked that because he took ordinary things and looked at the implications of those things, simple things, and I still remember. I could take it out now and look at it and find a great deal in it. One was that for you to be holy and me to be holy are two entirely different things. That you're an oak tree. You're an oak tree and I'm an elm. And that for you to reflect the glory of God as an oak tree is entirely different for me as an elm tree. Then there is when Walter got involved with this scrape that he did, that certain things came to really really help me, and one of them I even put on the wall, and now I don't have it. I do have it, but I didn't put it back up on the wall. One of them was the saying of Jung. Jung says that for certain people to be whole, it's sometimes necessary for them to explore thoroughly the shadow side of their life, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes it has disastrous effects, but that that person goes through that in order to be whole, and it's essential for them to do that. And I've thought about that, and I like Jung, but I'm not a scholar, and so if I had more time, I might study Jung, but it would mean I can't just read it, and I'm not disciplined enough to read it and get from it what I need. As far as a novelist goes, I love Kazantzakis, Nikos Kazantzakis, who wrote The Greek Passion and who wrote, what was it, The Last Temptation of Christ. I like The Greek Passion better. The Greek Passion is the story of the Passion of Christ. And it takes a small village in Greece, and the characters in that village play the figures in the Passion, and their lives parallel the lives of those people. At the same time, it takes, I think it was probably 100 years ago or so, there is a conflict between the Greeks and the Turks, and there's a small band of Christians who are kind of, what shall I say, they're penniless and sort of outcasts who need help and apply to other Christian communities, and they're rejected and so forth. And then it deals also with the Turk and the Turk leader who is a tyrant and who has a young boy that he is his sexual companion. It's a wonderful book, wonderful book. I like that. I do not analyze when I read, and I need to, I should do that. That's one of the reasons I'm not a good writer. I'm a writer, but not a great writer, probably never will be, is because I've never developed those faculties of discernment so that I examine how a writer achieves the effect he does.
I see.
I just read, and when I like it, I'm like a kid in a chocolate bar. I just enjoy it for the moment, and I know I like it, and I can tell the difference in the qualities of candy bars. Mm-hmm. So if writing is shallow, I don't like it, but I do not have the discriminatory faculties to do that, and therefore I am not a good critic and sometimes I question the critics too, because sometimes I read criticism of say films or a play, and I think a lot of that is phony also. I think that the person, the writer, often is demonstrating his or her knowledge and so forth, rather than to deal with the subject at hand. I kind of like historical novels because I like to learn about history as I am entertained by the writing. I read 30 books, 30, because I counted one down, on the war in Vietnam during the war. And that I can remember having discussions, arguments with people. And I knew that I knew more about the war. I knew more about the war than Hubert Humphrey. He had not read 30 books about the war. And of course, he was looking at it from the side of a government official, and I was not. I like Howard Zinn, as a political analyst. I like Noam Chomsky. Let's see, what other novelists? Ursula Le Guin, who is a science fiction writer, who writes about science fiction, but it's always in, not always, but the books that I read are in relationship to this society. She wrote a book about the moon, about people on Earth who are on a planet that went to the moon and lived, that where there's nothing. And on one planet, the people have everything. And it was a philosophical novel. See, I need something to kind of trip my memory as to the books I've read.
I remember when I read, and you had been reading them, Eric Fromm.
At that time, yes, and I still like Eric Fromm. You know, they kind of go in streaks in popularity.
Yes.
And then I remember what I do remember, and I bet it's true with you. a certain phrase or certain idea. I remember Bonaro and Harry, I think it was, Overstreet, who were psychologists, and who wrote, and I remember one thing I read. It said, the mature person chooses to be vulnerable. Hmm. And that was like a light turning on. That tells you why you do the stupid things you do. Because you choose that. You choose to be vulnerable. So when somebody gets at you, you can't say, I didn't know it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You chose that path. Mm-hmm. You choose to speak up mm-hmm. and have somebody say, mm-hmm. I know better than that. I mean, to make fun of you, to laugh at you, to put you down. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Because you chose that path. Mm-hmm. You're not a victim. Mm-hmm. So, let's see what else.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Oh yes, I love Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I gave you one of his
yes.
books, and he, you know, as opposed to Niemöller, I think it was Niemöller, he did choose, he was part of the conspiracy to kill Hitler, Bonhoeffer. You knew that.
I read it in his book somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, and so. And there is a film out. There are some films out about Bonhoeffer
right. yeah.
that I've seen one or two of them that are really nice.
Let's talk about, maybe we can get this from a different angle. So you talked about the 30 books on Vietnam. Any one of those books or any one author or anyone, as you were reading those books, what struck you? What started dawning on you? That you hadn't known before? What theme or?
It was not that way. It was just an unfolding. I think I told you that I knew about Vietnam from the very beginning. That Harry, Leonard Tinker was a Methodist minister
right.
from Iowa who was employed by the Quakers.
Right.
And he was my friend. I met his wife later. She told me she was always jealous of me. Leonard Tinker and I did nothing but sit down in the living room and talk. Of course, we had nothing going at all, but it was kind of cute. And he told me what was going to happen. And then I ran into him in Washington at a demonstration or so, and he told me about what was going on in the Congo then, about a man that our government killed. I can't think of his name now. And I stood up in a meeting and said something about this, and I really wasn't sure of my facts, but he wanted me to, and I did. Then, years later, I saw a movie about this man. It's like so much. He was a real hero, and he'd been killed. The same that happens to good people, you know. So, this is like, and I'll tell you, it's in my mind the same as I interpret the crucifixion of Christ, and I think we've talked about this. That because I do not accept Christ died for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
I don't accept that. What I accept is that Jesus did what he had to do and felt he had to do, and that he was like the rest of us. He didn't want to walk out there on a limb and have that limb break off. But he knew he had to walk, and that is the commission of Christians, is to walk out as far on the limb as they can possibly. I don't think they are called to get out there and have the limb chopped off, but at the same time, if they do, if what should be done, it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us are afraid, and I am too.
Mm-hmm.
My good living, my warm house, I really don't want to let, and I don't,
mm-hmm.
so I don't do it. But that is the commission.
As you say, you talk about that, it just, you know, again, it's hitting me that how you can talk the way you do, and I think, so much of religion and Christianity has been given a bad name by those who are trying to practice it. Mostly for themselves and
right,
their own
exactly.
salvation.
Exactly.
Maybe if that weren't going on so prevalently, you wouldn't have a problem identifying yourself as one.
As a Christian.
Right.
No, no, you see, I do. I do say, well, I don't think I do. No, I don't. I say I was raised Christian. That's what I say. See, I really don't. I don't say I am a Christian. Right. I say I was raised Christian.
Right.
And so, right. That's true. Because, you see, I see the clergy especially refusing my definition.
Right, as it did in the time of Christ.
Exactly, so they don't want
it. It's only the clergy that he had problems with.
That's right, they don't want to have the limb chopped off. So ultimately, and that's what I do say, they don't believe in crucifixion.
Right. Now, when I, just as an aside, 2 Sundays ago, I don't know if I mentioned this, at this Baptist church that we're going to, he showed a clip from Darfur, and he had not wanted to show it, but he...
Oh, he thought the people wouldn't like it.
Well, he said they clipped off some of the worst scenes, but he said he felt he had to show it. And then they had a couple of nights later, they had a meeting about Darfur and what you could do to help.
God knows what can you do.
Right. But here's somebody who's walking out on a limb.
Oh, that's right. And so those people are out there. They are. They are. So, anyhow, where was I going with that? Oh,
well,
that you asked me about the Quaker and well, because, and the, see, I have interpreted all of Christianity in my own.
Right, just life. Like Walter did.
Exactly. We have our own brand of Christianity. So that original sin, see, I don't believe in that either. But it's interesting, when I talk to Gabe, my friend who's a nun, we agree. You know, that is, so it isn't that far off even from conventional Christianity. Original sin is self, what is it, the tendency of self, to save yourself, what is it called? Self, you know the word.
Salvation or?
No, not salvation, but self, not gratification, but self-preservation.
Self-preservation.
That's original sin. Mm-hmm. And that was given to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not bad. But if we live in grace, what the Christians call grace, and you see again, I say the Christians call grace, we live aware that if somebody's in need, my obligation is to share. Is to share, and maybe to say me first if there's a question of who's in danger, that I go first, that I accept the danger before you do. That's living, and that self-preservation is not bad, because that saves us from snakes and all this kind of stuff, because we're concerned about our lives. So that's that.
You know, as I'm sure I shared at the time, but back years ago when I was in this group at church, I mean, the book by Vern Bittner that we used said that the basis of all sin is actually false pride, which is a little different spin on your self-preservation. And I think it's kind of orbiting around the same
planet, right, exactly, exactly.
Look at it.
And see, now when I went to Wyndham, I was brought up in the Methodist Church, and I went to the Methodist Church, and it was just all sin and, you know, hell and brimstone. Then I went to the Episcopal Church, and it was eventually it got too much for me, too much liturgy, and unwillingness to really address even the social justice issues that were present in Wyndham. And so then I decided I will never again join a church and have people tell me what my responsibilities are. I will define those myself, and so that's where I am.
Hmm.
But I have listened to Jews speak on the television. I could be a Jew, because their religion is based on justice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing that they say. They don't believe in the divinity of Christ. But I don't think any of them deny the existence of Christ.
Right.
So,
if you were to, and we're just a little off the subject, but if you were to, well, how much have you read the Bible in your life?
Oh, I've read the Bible. I've read a bit of the Bible. Yeah, I haven't read the whole Bible, but I've
King
read
James
the Bible.
King James Version, probably?
Yeah. Yes,
the
right.
The these and the thous that after a while kind of start to...
Yes, I have read the Bible, yeah. But you see, the Bible, even the New Testament is filled with killing and supporting it. Well, I shouldn't say supporting it, but saying God called down his wrath upon the people and the third son of the third son. I don't believe that worth it. I don't believe that at all. How would a loving God do that?
Well, it would be a God of justice.
To call down the killing of the third son of the third son? They'd never done anything to him, the third son of the third son. See, I think
it's a justice that goes beyond our comprehension of, you know, it's like I was talking to you about earlier. If the father sins, then that sin is passed on generation to generation. I mean,
but you don't go after them because their father sinned.
No.
See, I think that all of the Bible, and I know we disagree here, but that's okay,
right,
has to be interpreted in light of who Jesus was.
Mm-hmm.
Old Testament as well as New.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Old Testament was written by people at the time who had not heard about a new message. So, but I have read some of the Bible, and I, you know the 23rd Psalm. I bet you can't recite the books of the Bible. I can. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. I learned all that in Methodist Sunday school. Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job.
See, but I think if you just off this subject, yeah. But I think if you had a fresh contemporary version of the Bible and
yeah.
read most of the New Testament in that version,
I might like it.
I think you would like it.
Yeah, probably.
I think you would agree with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably would, because I don't disagree in the basic message.
Right. Yeah. It's that you have been overly exposed to the part of the message that actually isn't the main message, and that is judgment. You've heard judgment too much.
Well, you know, Mike, I don't know if it's that so much. It's what I haven't heard is a willingness to accept the call of the gospel. That hasn't disturbed me as much as the unwillingness of Christians to live out the message.
To go out on the limb.
Exactly. To go to Darfur.
Yeah.
To give $5 to that person at the intersection when I hand him a dollar. So, that's been my, and I actually wrote about this in a conversation I had with a man about at Hamlin, sitting next to me. We were at a dinner, and he talked about corporations, and he had represented corporations in South America or someplace, and what they were doing. And I mean, he was somewhat critical, and I said, well, then why should we have them? And he just could not believe it. He said, what do you mean? You know, we have to have corporations. It was again, you know, irreligious.
Mm-hmm.
The corporations, and that's almost where we are today in this, and that is where we are today in this country, is that capitalism is king. Capitalism is God.
Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you've read, and I've read and believe for some time, the only way capitalism can even come close to being something somewhat humane is if you have people who have a moral system,
right,
that they walk out every day. Otherwise, it becomes...
See, there are people, there's a woman that I know who's an economist, who says democracy and capitalism are absolutely irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm.
That one doesn't go with the other. I think you can have a controlled capitalism. I want to believe in it, to tell you the truth, because the alternative is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. I don't know. I think
I'm tired.
No, I'm not tired, but I just feel this is an exercise in I feel that this is vanity on my part.
Oh. Well, I don't think so. You're just
okay.
sharing who you
okay.
are.
All right. Okay.
I don't think that's vanity.
Yeah. Well, I feel. I mean, it's all me, and so
that's
I do.
Okay.
Okay.
That's what we're here for.
All right. Okay.
Sense. So let's just kind of take off from where we're at, and let me ask you this question: where is your thinking taking you lately? Where in politics or in anti-war movements or in, you know, every piece of peace church, which you could talk about, but you know what?
I do.
You know,
I think the reason that I have the dreams that I have is politically I despair. Mm-hmm. I do not see much future. I do not see the shopping malls and the sports and travel and attention to our crap. And so I do despair. I think I despair. And so I think that's what gives me these very frustrating dreams that I have, is my despair. I can't see how it can happen. It's not happening fast enough.
What?
Change.
Change in a positive.
Well,
you think it is happening?
No, I work at it. You work at it in our own way. We work at it, and I see people working at it. That's why I'm working with every church of Peace Church. But it doesn't happen fast enough. It would have to be skyrocketing now, and it isn't. On the other hand, now I've got this 36-page document written by Jack Nelson on global warming. And that's going to get us first. It's going to get us first. And I can't take that on.
I can't
deal with that.
Al Gore take it on.
I can't take that on. And yet I think it's very important. But it's all back to our lifestyle, that we live this great lifestyle. And now, as Lee mentioned to you, one of the things that's happening with what's going on in Iraq is this privatization of the oil. Our oil over there under their sand.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get our oil out of there, and so.
I think the thing that maybe I always speak for myself here, but I don't think it was the pastor of church; it was a visiting person. I think it might have been him, but he was talking about life and so forth. And towards the end, he said, "You know." I've read the end of the book, meaning the Bible.
Oh, yes.
I've read the end of the book, and we win.
Oh, that's nice. I'm trying to think about the end of the Bible. I don't think it says we win.
Well, a new heaven and a new earth.
Okay.
Coming down as a golden city.
Okay.
The old passes away.
Yes, that's true.
And we have a new heaven and a new earth.
Okay.
It's everything's new. The lion lays down with the lamb, and there's no more pain, there's no more suffering. And so I think one of the problems for Christians probably is not camping on that. If I just camp there...
You mean on the new, that it's going to happen?
That if I just camp on, it's everything's going to be fine. And
right.
Then I don't really have to worry too much
about right, darkness. Exactly. No, that's true. See, That's.
And I'm going to be safe. And yeah, right now somebody's going through hell in their life, but.
Right.
What
exactly.
Can you do anyway, and so
you accept it. It's like there's tomorrow. It's going to be okay.
Right, but I mean, I guess it. If I could, I'd say, you know, I believe the end of the book.
Yeah, right.
And so where somebody who doesn't have that may, not saying you, but somebody who doesn't have that may despair, I'll go to joy where that person will go to despair.
Well, true. The thing that helps my despair is being active, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And if I couldn't be active, I'd be writing more. I mean, mm-hmm. I've thought about that. If something happened and I ended up in a wheelchair, I'd just simply write.
Mm-hmm.
But Now, I was going to mention something. Oh, you know, right now, in addition, I'm working on an idea. I told you that. And the idea is this conference about children.
I don't think you have.
Oh, no. Well, you see, I read on the internet some big anti-war group is going to have this big conference. Okay? They come to nothing. So I've been talking to some social worker friends of mine about having a conference on the well-being of children worldwide. And I said we would just make war one aspect of it, but I'm not, somebody else said, I think you've got to make war the main aspect. But it would be to try to get people who are concerned about children that think people who are all upset about war may be a little bit too much.
Uh-huh.
And talk about the well-being of children in Darfur, the well-being of children in far as child soldiers are concerned, the well-being of young girls who are being raped by soldiers, the well-being of, mothers during wartime, and go at war through talking about children, that we have an obligation toward to the self, to the well-being of all children everywhere, and try to have a national conference on it. And then, at the national conference, here, say to the people who attend, go back to your own state and have another conference, because we've got to mobilize the people. And if mothers, well, the fact is, I spoke to Sarah, she said, we'll call ourselves a brigade, a grandmother's brigade. And I said, that's just too militaristic, but it would be women then, and it would not be a political movement per se, but the object would be political, because we can't get at the politicians. They're not, we can't reach any of them.
No, as soon as they're in front of a camera, they're shot.
Well, my friend Keith is gone.
Yeah, as soon as they're in front of a camera, it's over.
He's with Nancy Pelosi, and he's made it. He's the darling of the political party. He's a Muslim, and he's gone. So if the mothers, it could work, you know. I'm not just goofy about this idea, but I'm pursuing it, and my friends, who are likewise serious about it, are pursuing it. And so we're gonna, we've talked about. I wrote up a big statement, a mission statement, and they, of course, tore it to pieces because they're professional. They know how to do this kind of stuff. They didn't really tear it to pieces. They just said, we need this, we don't need that, we need this, we need that. But I think we're going to go ahead with it. And
great.
I don't care if I, and this is true, I don't care if I get any credit at all for it. If it happens, my gosh, I feel just great. So the Children's Defense Fund, my friend, the social worker, one of them said, that would be the logical place to go. We don't even care if it's taken away from us. If they said, we're going to do this, go back to Minnesota and go to sleep, we're going to do it.
Oh, the Children's Defense Fund.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody else likes the idea and runs with it, we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to have, the concern has got to be about the issue and not power play and not mm-hmm. being the big whoever does it, you know. But by and large, that's one thing we haven't had in WAM. One thing I attribute to its success is there's no power there. There's no acclaim for being involved with that organization. We're not asked to speak in any great big things. And that's what saved us. Because nobody wants to get to the top of an organization that doesn't have any political clout or isn't recognized.
Which it isn't.
No. No. Nobody knows about it. You know, some people know, but then I'm surprised when they do. I'm surprised when they do.
Somewhere I was traveling somewhere, I think in South Dakota, maybe the Black Hills, or somewhere out of state, and I saw wind bumpers.
It's kind of funny. Yeah. So, Patty Guerrero said she, you know, Patty, she's erratic. She said she was parked a car at the mall, and she couldn't get in the space, and she was kind of halfway here or there. She had all these bumper stickers, and Somebody had left her a message and said, you may be against military mandates, but you sure as hell don't know how to park a car.
That's funny.
Yeah, it is funny. So, that's it. So, I've got a play that I've written that we're going to read. We're going to read it now, going back to plays at Patty's. It's a story, and we'll talk about that a little bit, because there's something in it. I don't know. I don't think it would be bad for you to do this stuff, because you could do it easy, and you could start out at it easy. About John Peter Zenger. You've never heard of him. He was a German immigrant to this country, and he published a newspaper. And he published a newspaper, and this was the time before the United States was the United States. It was still under the crown of England.
Okay.
And he wrote he criticized the government for what it had done. And what had they done? Oh, he made several statements about it, what they had done. And they charged him with libel. And this is, he's not even in this. This is the court scene. And it established the principle. The judge, of course, was against him and said that he established the principle that in order to be libelous, something has to...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned that the other night.
Yeah, they can't be true.
Yeah.
And that principle was established that if it's true, it cannot be liable. And so that still holds today. So it's going to be kind of fun. I went over it, and I don't know where I got the language, but I've got all the old language in there. It's not modern day language. I think I had something from the encyclopedia, because it wasn't me. It was what I had copied. But it'll be fun to do it. And I thought I'd get Bob Babbitt. He said he would read one of the parts. And then another man I know who's pompous, this Phil Wilkie, to be the judge, and then a third person, maybe one of Patty's sons who's an attorney, to be the other part. And it would...
When is this going to be done, or
where? I don't know. She's going to give me a date, and I'm going to have to work on it.
And it's one reading?
Just one reading.
Well, I might be interested.
Oh, all right. If we do it, if you want to read the part, you can read the part of one of the lawyers. It's just a part, you know.
Just read
a part. All right, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Would you expect us to have it memorized?
No. Not even to rehearse it. You just read it when you get there. Yeah.
Well, I'd probably read it first once.
Oh, well, yeah. So.
Might be fun.
Yeah. I think I told you in California this. We went to see this play, and the man, Morris Bobro, who was the production company on Shopping. And it was just a light little play, I told you that, on Shopping.
I don't think so.
Well, Connie and I went, and it was, what I like and what he had is he's a musician, so he had this little patter with it, and the people sang it. All the things that happen when you go shopping, the woman who goes shopping, and she has these bags from these expensive places, and then when she gets ready to go, she goes and looks at all her bags to see whether she's going to carry a bag from Tiffany's, or a bag from Lord & Taylor's or whatever. And then the funniest one was a scene where this woman gets to the checkout counter, and then the man is handing her amount she owes, and she says, oh, I've got a coupon here. And then after he gets out, she said, then I want to return this. This is not exactly what I wanted. And that goes on for about 10 minutes. And it's silly. And it has no social import whatsoever. But I enjoyed it. And I wrote him and sent him my play, Princess Faye, and asked him if he'd be interested.
Yeah.
And he wrote me back and said, he said, pursue it. I think I told you that. But he said he has to do it himself. He can't get interested in doing somebody else's stuff. So. That was it. So,
just a thought on your children's conference.
Yeah.
Every 2 years they have what's called a... I think I'll turn this off.
Okay.